This morning, the green fists of the peonies are getting ready to break my heart. As the sun rises, as the sun strokes them with his old buttery fingers, and they open, pools of lace, white and pink, and all day the black ants climb over them, boring their deep and mysterious holes into the curls, craving the sweet sap, taking it away in the darkness, underground cities, and all day under the shifty wind, as if in a dance to a great wedding, the flowers bend their bright bodies and tip their fragrance to the air and rise, their red stems holding all that dampness and recklessness, gladly and lightly. And there it is again, beauty, the brave, the exemplary, blazing open. Do you love this world? Do you cherish your humble and silky life? Do you adore the green grass with its terror beneath? Do you also hurry half-dressed and barefoot into the garden and softly, exclaiming of their dearness, fill your arms with the white and pink flowers, with their honeyed heaviness, their lush trembling, their eagerness to be wild and perfect for a moment before they are nothing forever? Tonight's talk is on the fear of not knowing, the fear of not knowing. Continuation of several talks on the different disguises and expressions of fears that we all have. Trying to get to sort of the basics of the foundation of some of these fears and where they seem to indicate a grasping at the sense of me. If we go too far up the food chain, we don't know what the next level of fear is. I'm trying to get us so that we actually see our formation and some of the underlying carpeting of that foundation, of that the fear of that carpeting, which leads to the formation of the sense of me, the sense of self. And tonight I'd like to begin, perhaps persuaded by the ambiance of the light with Once Upon a Time. Once Upon a Time, take you back to the Garden of Eden, if I could, in which biblically the analogy fits very nicely with what we're talking about tonight. There was a time when distinctions weren't made, when separation wasn't a given. And then through whatever reasons, someone ate from the apple of knowledge, and suddenly distinctions were everywhere. With a single bite of that apple, there arose the 10,000 things of the world, the multiplicity of the world. And once the genie is out of the bottle, you can tell that it's very hard to stuff the poor critter back in. In fact, we cannot go back to that innocence. We've already seen multiplicity. But does that mean that there is no avenue for freedom? Well, obviously not. But it isn't in trying to forget the world of multiplicity. And many of us believe that the spiritual path has something to do with going back to the innocence of that, where we don't know distinctions anymore, where everything is homogenized. But that's not the path at all. At least it's not the path that I practice. But rather, can we hold knowledge for its use and utility, navigating through the labyrinth of our lives, being able to drive back home and know the directions, be able to engage in a vocation that needs knowledge base and knowing, and at the same time arrive back home at the mystery. But without in any way avoiding the understanding of multiplicity, so that both of them come back in. It's very interesting when you begin to see what real freedom is, when we get an intimation of what real freedom is. Many of us have projected a very distorted path upon ourselves and try to live up to that distortion, only to find out that there really isn't anything we have to do at all except release ourselves from the resistance and fear that we have of things, which came with the first bite of that apple. Because with the first bite of that apple, and I saw distinctions, then there were things that we liked, and when there are things that we like, there are also, in reverse, things that we fear. And so we keep seeing and holding ourselves in resistance to life through that fear response that is, that outside of its physical call towards safety, really has little bearing upon us at all. Little rational bearing upon ourselves. And so tonight, the fear of not knowing really gets at a fundamental question, I think. I hope you do as well. Because when we question that, we have to question our approach to Dharma. What do we come and listen to these talks for? Is it to gather more information? Is it to increase our knowledge base of the philosophies of Buddhism? What is it about? Because we can see the road separate at a very important juncture here. And where we have normally followed the path, the one that's most downtrodden, is the path of knowing. And here we're asked to follow a different path, the path that liberates us from the tyranny of knowing. Because although knowing itself is essentially benign, we use it in a malicious way, against ourselves and against the world at large. So to know what path we're on, why do we sit? We don't sit to reinforce the muscle of knowledge. We sit to empty. We sit to release. We sit to not resist. And I think some of us need to shore up that understanding in ourselves. Fear of not knowing. What does that bring forth in us? Fear of what the next moment might bring. We don't know. Insecurity of that, of having no ground under me. Fear of transition and impermanence. Fear of who I am if I don't have security in the next moment. Fear of not having a direction. Fear of not getting from life what I most desire. My partner, a relationship, children. What if I don't have, what if life isn't? Not having financial security, fear of what will happen to me in old age. You see, it just throws the not knowing and how we constantly work towards making that not knowing known. How we constantly bite the apple from the garden again and again because we feel life is, in its essential raw form, is far too threatening. Far too threatening. Why? Because we have made distinctions. And in that distinction, it is threatening. When, as soon as we make distinctions, we have to protect that which has made the distinction, to keep it distinct. So there's an existential crisis. Now, that existential crisis calls forth in us an endless working out of our future. We want our future to be resolved. Not knowing is too unformed, ambiguous. So we're constantly trying to work out our future to get over the hurdle of the fear of not knowing. Now the future, by anyone's criteria, can only remain unknown. But that doesn't stop us from trying. Because the mind is in terror of the present moment. Because when it looks at the present moment, it feels its incompletion. What the present moment represents to us is deficiency. Where I am not where I want to be. Now, let's look at that, because that's such an interesting point, because everything forms right there. If we look even closer at the present moment, what we see is a mood of inadequacy or boredom, which makes this moment, through our mind's interpretation of that mood, the story of the me comes into play and says, well, I'm insufficient in this moment. It's boring. It's not exciting enough. Therefore, the resolution of that boredom or inadequacy is in the future, has yet to be obtained. And so I have to look, I have to work diligently, not to steady myself here and now, but to try to get over here and now towards what I think of is the resolution of the problem. But is that the resolution of the problem? What about if we just held inadequacy as itself rather than let it bite us into working it out? Okay. What if we just held boredom for on its own terms? Not let it capture the story of the me to play out what I need to do to get out of boredom. Then would there be fear of future? Then would there be the fear of not knowing? But as soon as the story, your story, my story, comes into play, then fear has to come into play. Because we're running from that legitimacy. The only legitimacy we have is in the here and now. The only truth of our standing place is in the here and now. Once we have decided to run from there, we get the whole story of the sense of myself running with it, but we never get the complete freedom that it can only be obtained here and now. Do you see the paradox in that? And fear always is about the future. All fears. And if we look closer, it's always because we're running from some sense of self-inadequacy. Or seeing insufficiency in some aspect of the moment. Perceiving insufficiency. The terror of the present. So what's the payoff? I'd like to find, what's the payoff of the knowing mind? The knowing mind. Well, very few of us would have ever established any foothold on this path without it. Because you can see how chaotic your inward world is without a map and direction and view of what is occurring. When you first sat down, and when you sit down now, quite likely, you will feel the chaos of your life in forms of thoughts, emotions, moods, attitudes. Almost like the lottery wheel that turns those tickets, mauls them on top of each other. The waterfall effect of our thoughts. And without a map, without a guidepost, it would create an enormous sense of inward chaos and terror. And so the Buddha established a blueprint for what to make have a blueprint for what is occurring here, a context for us to be able to understand what is happening, and a roadmap on which we can walk this practice, and a view that we can hold while we're walking. All of those things are more bites out of the apple, but vital and important if we are to ingest this practice sufficiently before fear takes hold and we have no bearing, no stability under our feet whatsoever. So establishing a view, an intentionality, a purpose, a blueprint, a guide is extremely important. And as the Buddha's metaphor of a raft sailing across, you sail across on that view, on that knowledge until you reach the other side, but then you get off the raft. And so many of us are on the raft, and I want to assure you I'm not going to rip it out from under your feet, but some of us are close to the other end. And it may be that most of us are close to the other end. We just don't account for ourselves to be there. In fact, I would say that was more likely than not. We don't credit ourselves sufficiently to know that we're ready. We say, and there are paths in Buddhism which will endlessly say to you, so heed the words, that there is more to do. There's more to do. And even though these teachers have been practicing 30, 40, 50 years, there's still more to do. Because they're not looking just upon years, they're looking upon lifetimes. More to do. When are we going to arrive? And how will we know we arrive when the sense of inadequacy is driving the more to do? When you think the sense of inadequacy is going to go away, since we have given it 50 years of fleeing from it? No. It's behind the scenes, too subtle to notice for many, that it's driving the need for time, the need to know, the need for security, the need for the future. So the payoff in which it gives us a blueprint can very quickly become the object and purpose. The blueprint can take on the path. The path can take on the purpose. And the purpose has its own intention and its own enmeshment in the forever of time in working it out. So not, again, to dismiss knowledge. It organizes and regulates our lives. Psychologically, it allows order and predictability, safety. In fact, the world must be stable before we can question it. It is only from a stabilized world, in which, in fact, we have some leisure time, which is just enormously privileged. First, to hear the Dharma, to be around and accessible to it. Secondly, to be stable enough so that you can hear it. And thirdly, to be wealthy enough, if I can use those terms, to have some leisure time in which you can bring forth the focus that is needed. Tremendously privileged. But the world needs to be questioned. And it can't be questioned when it's topsy-turvy. Have you ever tried to question the world when you're in the middle of uprooting yourself, a relationship breaks, or you're changing homes, or the stressor factor of your life is over 100? It's very difficult to do that. And it takes a deep, abiding understanding to be able to do that. Mostly when we have some leisure, when we're relatively healthy, when we're settled, when we're having minor difficulties, perhaps the heat in the room or something of that nature, then we can begin to bring forth our Dharma understanding, which retreats quickly into its mouse hole when there's any sort of tragedy or difficulty that might arise. Wards off the terror. Knowledge wards off the terror, the inward terror of our chaos. I was reading about people who had been blind since birth, and in their 20s or 30s or 40s, or at some point, a medical cure was discovered for their blindness. And so then people were there to record what happened to them when the blindfolds were removed, or when they first opened their eyes to sight. And you know what happened? Almost to a person, they wanted the blindfold back on, because it was too chaotic. They had no way to organize the data, to make it meaningful, to synthesize it. And knowledge does that. I mean, these are just random images otherwise, just shapes and colors coming at, moving, and better to go back and be blindfolded. But knowledge, knowing, breaks down when we attempt to apply it to our internal standards of, or internal sense of I, me, and mine. Why? Because knowing, knowledge, is always fixed. It doesn't move. It doesn't change. And inwardly, as we well know, we do. Everything is in flux. And for us to take knowledge and apply it to something that is inherently turbulent, in transition, makes no sense at all. It comes out making statements that are absurd, insane. I am angry person. I am a happy person. I am, put any, fill in the blank, and it's an insane statement. In fact, the Buddha said such. He said, those who go around claiming ownership of their inward process are completely mad. So what we try to do is to make life meaningful inwardly, and we try to make life meaningful outwardly by labeling and knowing things to give us that inward sense of stability and the outward sense of stability, even though everything is in chaos. The fluidity, just feel the fluidity of life. And knowledge works counter to the reality of that change. It's in opposition to the reality of this change. Anytime we fix and locate anything, we're working in opposition to the facts that are contained in reality. And it's interesting, the more fixed we become in our knowledge base, the more opinionated we become and rigid we become in personality. I think that's interesting. And the more positions we take, the more judgments we have. Now look at ourselves. You see? And the older we become, the more habitual we become in our responses of labeling and knowing, the more rigid, and you can feel in body and in mind that rigidity set in just through our constant referencing life to be a fixed and discrete assembly of things. So why is not knowing so difficult? Why is it so difficult? Why is not knowing so difficult? I mean, that's a fair question. Because to be in a position of not knowing is helpless. We feel completely impotent, without power, without a place. And that is probably the most noxious experience we can have. But the next time you feel helpless, try to be quietly helpless. Just see if you can hold the experience of helplessness. Just see if you can. If you are a scientist, you're always working on the edge of what you don't know. And is that edge, are you comfortable in that edge? Because that's the edge of the question. That's the edge where the fixation of knowledge is insecure or less secure. That's where the position isn't firm. And do we try to get over that feeling of helplessness to get to the answer, to arrive at the position, to arrive at the fixation, driven not for the purpose of the answer, but to get away from the helplessness? It's an interesting one. And habits, for those of you who, like me, find yourself getting older and more habitual in your responses, more encrusted. And if anyone outside of you, it's not just our own activities, it's the significant others that we live with or people who are around, and if they don't follow the habitual response that they're used to doing, then there's conflict. The cap off the toothpaste. Or whatever. And habits, it's important to understand, and I hope everyone picked up one of the homework sheets, because this then puts us on the road of not knowing the homework, rather than just listening to the talk and going and discussing it and increasing the base of what we do know. We want to work this week at the boundaries of what we do know and to work with our habits, to see our habits, to begin to understand that our habits are the solidification of action through knowledge, through security, through safety. And so are protocols and manners. I don't know if any of you watch, I can't remember the name of it. It's on every Sunday and on the public TV and Victoria. It's always about Victorian England. Anyway, the manners during that time. Everything is just so rigid, and you can't walk outside. You can't take. There's no air to breathe. You feel this rigidity, which is why I can't watch those programs, because it's just like so tight. Everything's so moralistic and tight. But that's the way the mind that feeds on apples grows. The unbridled, knowledge-based existence, that's the way it grows. Ugh. So you apply habit, we apply a formula. A formula to life. We make it formula-based, doesn't it? And it keeps not knowing at bay, of course. And a habit keeps repeating past. It's just reliving past. I don't have to think about this. You see, we may feel awkward, and so the manners are all, we don't have to think about it. We don't have to go in and live the experience of it, because when we do that, we have to feel helpless. So the habit covers over the helpless feeling we would have without it. The raw sense of aliveness which is what helplessness is. Another word for helplessness is innocence. Not naiveness. Now, Helen Keller, who had no sight and no power to hear, said, "Security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature." This is somebody who can't see or hear. "Avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing at all." And the antithesis of Dharma is automatic pilot. The antithesis of Dharma is habit. And to wake ourselves up in all of the different ways, all of the different side roads and activities that we take, to wake up all of that is to wake ourselves back up to the feelings that drove us into those patterns. Helplessness, discouragement. That's what we uncover when we uncover. Well, just take the toothbrush that you and put it in your other hand and try to brush your teeth. Immediately frustration or annoyance comes. You're helpless. I'm not doing that stupid exercise. See? Why? Because of the feeling. The feeling drives it. The feeling drives it. But then you see, in knowing, knowing, the habit covers over something much more enticing. It covers over the mystery of life. The peonies, the reason I read that poem is because of that line, "Do you love the flowers? But also, you run out onto the earth with the terror beneath." I mean, because whenever we expose ourselves to that sort of endless joy, you have to also face the fear which has protected us from that joy. And that's the downside of a life that's just lived in knowing, is that it ensconces us, encases us, so that real joy cannot touch us, so that we have no access to joy. Because joy is not found in the ritual. It's not found in the routine, in the protocol, in the manner, in the habit. It's not found in the world of safety, in laws, in governance. And to run out on the grass with the terror beneath, so that your heart can fly open to the wonders that lie, is really where the Dharma takes us, moves us, deep into the projection, through our projections, into the mystery itself. Because the mystery means not knowing. How can a mystery mean knowing? Mystery means not knowing. You wouldn't read a book, well, maybe you would, I don't know, a mystery novel where you knew the ending. I've read this before, but I just would like to read it once more if I could. And that is the Joseph Campbell story. In The Art of the Pilgrimage, Phil Cousineau tells the following story of Joseph Campbell giving advice to a young woman before she embarks on a pilgrimage to Greece. He had just given a talk to a small audience on the nature of the goddess. The young woman had made precise calculations of the best times to visit every major cultural attraction and just where and when she would make her salutations to the different deities whose statues remained. "Do you think this is sufficient?" she pressed him. "Do you think I will find the spirit of the goddess in Greece? Joe, who had been staring at her a while, with a parade of mixed emotions played over his face, took her one free hand in his and with great kindness and solemnity said, "Dear lady, I sincerely hope that all does not go as planned." With that, he slipped into his overcoat and we left the building. Sitting in the back seat of the car on the drive home, I could barely contain my curiosity. Finally, mustering all the courage of my 17 years, I leaned over the front seat and said, "Mr. Campbell, that woman who was going to Greece, why did you tell her you hoped that Things did not go as planned. Joe paused as if trying to sort through all the encounters of the evening, and then threw back his head and laughed with a mystic's glee. How will the gods ever find her when she has done everything in her power to make sure they will never will? Then he said soberly, Unless you leave room for serendipity, how can the divine enter? The beginning of the adventure of finding yourself is to lose your way. I don't know how many of you have had the experience, perhaps all of you, of just synchronicity of the universe, where it comes back in magically, where we have crossed the threshold of habit and the world is in this no man's, no person's land of mystery. I was staying at Gaia House for a long retreat a few years back, and I went to the library of Gaia House on one occasion just to see if I could get a book that would motivate me and inspire some reflection and some questioning. And I had been a student of Nisargadatta Maharaj many, many years in 1980, and I saw a book by him on the bookshelf. I pulled it down and it opened up. And I started to read where it opened up. It just opened up. And I just started to read it. And I said, God, this really sounds familiar. I looked at the date in which the interview was taped. And it was January 1980. And I started to read and I thought, my God, this is an interview I had with him. I remember it being recorded. I had no idea that there had been any transcription of that or anything. And there it was. And my eyes just lit upon the book. It wasn't like I spent even 5 minutes in the library. It was really the first book I went to. And there it was. The serendipity. What's the chance of that? Well, those of you who are habitual in your chaos theory will find a probability of that. I don't need further proof. Because probability always stands ready to take that away. I don't need further proof. How much proof do we need? You see, that's what lies behind our worry. That's what lies behind our need to know. That's what lies behind our mistrust, our fear of not knowing. It's always playing forth through our lives, and in fact is the very embodiment of life itself. But we're too afraid to honor that. We keep giving it credit, self-credit. We keep obscuring the magic and making it self-empowered. It's all magic. How can it not be? So the message this evening is to trust and relax. To trust and relax. I was yesterday, actually, I got a call on the telephone. I picked it up, and it was a woman who was on retreat at Spirit Rock doing a 2-month retreat. And she was calling me in the middle of the retreat. I didn't know her. She had an interview with one of the teachers, and I think he told her, give me a call. So anyway, she calls me. So she says, my husband died 3 months ago, and I've been having dreams about him in which we are communicating. And I feel the dreams are so real. In fact, sometimes when I'm wide awake, I have a very deep sense of not only his presence, but also a communicative link. And she says, so then And the next moment, I'll start doubting that. And I don't trust it. And I've got to know, she says, I've got to know, is this real? And I said, I have no idea. It could go either way. How would I know? But why do you have to know? Why don't you just relax? And if it feels, I mean, you see, what she was trying to do is to perpetuate the connection of his aliveness so that they would have some method of further communication. And so her whole, you know, she was grieving. That's what she was doing. I've got to know. I've got to know. You see? I just know one thing. If we choose knowledge, we will be held captive by what knowledge offers: power, possessions, and self-image. If we choose that road, that is what it offers. And if we choose to live in reality, we will be transformed, but the price of that will be our empowerment. So those are the options. And really, the whole path is getting from one road to the other, of moving, of crossing over, of giving up, of trusting sufficiently so that we can release our fear and need to know, to come to hallowed grounds, to start walking in a very different way. Because most of us want to know the moment, we don't want to live the moment. We have more to know, we have more to do, we've got more to do. See, that's the forever of knowledge. There's no end in knowledge. It's the forever. It's just the same thing as working out your salvation. It's just a different metaphor. I need to know more biology. Or I need to know more about myself. Or I need to put in more practice time. It's all the same road. So how do we break that hold, you see? I think this is where I really believe the practice of choice is the practice of questioning. Holding a question is inherently fearful because we are helpless in the face of a question in which we genuinely don't know the answer. It can be a nonsensical question like a koan, or it can be a question of who am I? Or what is this? Or where is there love in this moment? Or some question that takes us into quietude instead of the turbulence of noise where we can always default to words. Ever deeper into the unknown. That's what a question does. But we don't want the question, we want the answer. The answer is driven by the helplessness we feel in having the question. We want to get over the helplessness, and the answer will provide that. So we're driven to the answer rather than allowing ourselves just to trust and be relaxed within the question itself. Yet the question is much closer, if I can use measurement, to the truth of reality than the answer. Deeper into the mystery of that. It breaks the fixation of knowing. A question breaks the fixation of knowing. And we are like people on a monkey bars, just keep going from one knowing moment to the next knowing moment. And suddenly, with a question, we have no bar to grab. We lose our momentum. We lose the, and it only takes an instant, you see, it's not, although the habit is deep and profoundly strengthened from years of giving it our agreement, it's still only an instant in which we can break it. It's only It's as fragile as crystal. Just like that. And you feel in that, you feel all of the earth, the lifetime momentum. I want to know. I've got to find out. I have to. And if you just, with a little introspection, if we just look behind that urge to see what's driving it. Okay, that's okay. But my reputation. Okay. You can go that way, but you've been going that way for 58 years. Why do you... But everything I... You see, it's just everything. It's everything. I like that. I love that moment in which we continue to move back onto the conveyor belt of our habit. And we do it through choice. Okay, I want the reputation, and then I'll die, and that's, you know, at least I'll have something. You're not offering me anything. Teacher once was asked, isn't enlightenment the ultimate state of knowing? No, he answered, the ultimate state is being. The price is knowing. I'd like to finish with a verse from the Tao Te Ching. The named is mother to the 10,000 things, but the unnamed is origin to all heaven and earth. In perennial non-being, you see mystery, and in perennial being, you see appearance. One and the same, they're called dark enigma. Dark enigma, deep within dark enigma, gateway of all mystery. Can we sit for a minute or two?